Epilogue. Being sequestered in a hotel for a week or two with the other jurors while we reached our verdict had its challenges. All available accommodation in Morwell had been booked out by a phenomenal global media presence, and that meant we ended up being in the same hotel as a lot of the media. This wasn't entirely a cock-up. The Supreme Court couldn't pre-book accommodation for us because they could not predict when the trial's hearing days would end. And Morwell was packed. It was a difficult situation to manage. And the journos, to their credit, desperately tried to keep it out of our way. They didn't want to see the whole trial abandoned because of one stupid incidental conversation. For me personally, it also meant I couldn't get to the factory each night and keep up with our framing orders, so that was a bit of a stress. Nonetheless, it paled in comparison to the responsibility we had. Once the verdict had been delivered, however, I did become aware that another legal fight had begun, within minutes. In a country that holds dear the notion of open justice, tradition holds that after a conviction has been recorded, all records of the evidence previously deemed inadmissible should be made public, so that everyone can see the way in which the justice system has been fair. Fair to the accused and fair to the victims. In Erin Patterson's case, Justice Beale initially decided not to release this pre-trial material in order, he claimed, to protect Erin's appeal rights. In other words, if, on appeal, a retrial was ordered, Erin's case might be severely compromised because any potential juror would probably have seen and read all the stuff that had previously been deemed too prejudicial. But this was an unusual case, given the unprecedented global interest in it. Almost any potential juror at any retrial would surely have read something. So that decision was immediately challenged by several of the biggest media organisations in the world on the basis that, to put it in common parlance, it seemed to imply someone wasn't finally, truly convicted until after the appeal process had been exhausted. It was sort of saying that after a diligent and rigorous jury trial, you were still only convicted-ish until the appeal process had played out. Big media won the day on that one. And about 4 weeks after we'd delivered our guilty verdict, nearly all the pre-trial material was released, including Justice Beale's rulings on which pieces of evidence he had ruled inadmissible and why. Only one piece of inadmissible evidence remained suppressed, and I have no idea what that is. Well, I do, but I can't say. But what was released was sensational enough, and it kept the case on page one everywhere for another God knows how long. What generated the biggest news by far were the details around the three attempted murder charges that were dropped on the eve of the trial. In fact, the OPP was ordered by the Court of Appeal to sever the indictment, meaning that those charges would have to be heard at a separate trial, and then it was decided to drop the attempted murder charges altogether. And under the appeal court's ruling, coincidence evidence, evidence of a similar crime, about an accused person cannot be used against the accused unless the probative value of the evidence substantially outweighs any prejudicial effect it may have on the accused. A lot of words in that ruling require subjectivity. What is probative value, anyway? I think in everyday language it means the amount of undisputed truth about the matter at hand that is revealed by that piece of evidence. Still, who decides what the probative value of something is and how that is to be measured? Who decides what amounts to substantially? And who decides prejudicial effect? Since when is that something you can weigh in kilograms? It is, in essence, all a matter of opinion. There is no law of nature here, like gravity or the speed of light. This is a group of humans making a subjective decision. But just give me a second to dismount from my high horse and get back to the nitty-gritty. Exactly what were the three attempted murder charges that had been dropped and excluded from Erin's trial because they fell foul of being coincidence evidence. Charge number one. In November 2021, Erin had suggested she and Simon should go on a hiking trip to Wilson's Promontory without the kids. On Tuesday, the 16th of November 2021, Erin went to Simon's house to pack for the trip, and she gave him a Tupperware container of penne bolognese. Simon ate it that night and the next morning started vomiting. He continued to vomit and suffer diarrhea as they drove to Wilson's Promontory. They stayed in an Airbnb and Simon wanted to go to hospital, but Erin advised against that, saying it would be such a long wait. Finally, on the 19th of November, Erin drove Simon back to Gippsland and took him to Leongatha Hospital. He was diagnosed with severe dehydration and acute renal impairment, with modestly elevated lactate. He was then transferred to Monash Medical Centre, where he remained until the 27th of November 2021. Extensive testing by medical staff at the time could not determine the underlying cause of his illness. Charge number two. A few months later, Erin suggested that she and Simon should plan another camping trip without the kids, since the previous one hadn't worked out. Simon said, yeah, okay, and they planned a trip to Hauqua, about 130 kilometres northeast of Melbourne. On the 24th of May 2022, they were camping at Hauqua when they ate chicken korma curry that Erin had prepared and packed in separate containers. The next day, Simon vomited and had diarrhoea all morning. Erin drove him to Mansfield Hospital, stopping along the way so he could vomit. They then drove home, but by the 29th of May, Simon's condition had only got worse and he asked Erin for help. She went to his house and called an ambulance, which took him to Casey Hospital in southeast Melbourne. Here he was admitted in a state of hemodynamic shock. He had lactic metabolic acidosis, multiple organ failure, and markedly elevated lactate levels, which suggested liver ischemia. A blood film test was consistent with severe sepsis. He was intubated and admitted to intensive care in an induced coma. Again, doctors were unable to determine the cause of his illness. He was in that induced coma for 16 days until the 14th of June, and on the 22nd of June, he was transferred to a rehabilitation centre where he remained until the 8th of July. After that, he underwent weekly blood tests to see if the cause of his illness could be determined. During this period, Erin was moving out of Shelcott Road and into her brand new house in Leongatha. Simon was in hospital the whole time. On the 22nd of July, Erin prepared a beef stew with rice, which both she and Simon ate for lunch. The next morning, Simon became ill again, with vomiting and diarrhoea. Miraculously, Erin was fine, but Simon went straight to Leongatha Hospital and was transferred to Monash Medical Centre, again, where he remained for several days. This incident was actually considered part of the second attempted murder. Charge number three. On the 6th of September 2022, Simon and Erin went for another walk around Wilson's Promontory. Erin had brought them pre-prepared lunches, each one separately wrapped. Again, shortly after lunch, Simon started to vomit and feel unwell. Erin drove him to Don and Gail's house and they called an ambulance. Simon suffered a seizure and was in a reduced conscious state. He was admitted to the Casey Hospital intensive care unit and was intubated again. He was discharged on the 9th of September. So this was all happening just before the blow-up over child support payments, when Erin thought Simon was being so unreasonable and vindictive. And why was all this ruled inadmissible? It came down to circular reasoning. On each occasion, there was no clear evidence or proof that Erin had deliberately caused Simon's illness with her meals. It just looked that way in hindsight, given what happened on the 29th of July 2023. However, once it was determined that Erin's lunch guests on the 29th of July had been deliberately poisoned, then it looked almost certain that that had happened in these cases too. but that had not been determined yet, so these episodes could not be presented as evidence. And around we go. Chuck 'em out. They can't form part of the case against Erin. But why couldn't the law let a jury see all this and just explain it to them? The law is so big on being magnanimous at the beginning of a trial, when it declares to a jury, you are the judge of the facts. But what it is really saying is, you are only the judge of a particular set of facts that we trust you to make a fair decision on. We can't trust you with all these other facts. You might be prejudiced. Perhaps it would be better to show us a lot more evidence and trust us to decide what to accept or not. What do those other attempted murder charges mean? Well, it might have been hard to gain a conviction on those charges alone. In each of the three charges, no clear medical evidence directly and deliberately connects Simon's illness to the meals Erin prepared. But for me, they did at least answer one huge question. I had often wondered how on earth Erin ever thought she could get away with lacing food with poison. The answer is now clear to see, because she already had, 3 or 4 times before. On all previous occasions, for whatever combination of reasons, she had outsmarted the medical profession, and she had always thought doctors were dolts anyway. Why would she think her beef Wellington lunch would be any different? Those dumb doctors were never going to figure out what had happened. They hadn't in the past, and they wouldn't now. Of all the inadmissible material that was released to the public, the 3 attempted murder charges made the biggest splash. But there were several incidents, Erin alleged, and, if true, they indicated a volatile breakdown in the relationship with Simon throughout 2023. Unfortunately, however, all of the allegations she made were unsubstantiated, and when Erin is asking you to take her at her word, it's so hard to say what's true and what isn't. I can imagine, however, given Simon's history with Erin over the course of 2022, as evidenced by the 3 dropped murder charges, that it had become a very suspicious, defensive, and challenging relationship. Only natural, wouldn't you think? But there was one other piece of evidence ruled inadmissible that really does annoy me now that it has been made public. Part of Erin's case had been her shame and embarrassment about her supposed bulimia and her desperation for gastric bypass surgery. At the end of the day, that had been the whole reason for the lunch, she had told us. I hadn't bought it, but the rest of the jury room had hesitated to dismiss it entirely. This was partly because they wondered if they could believe the story she had told us about her actions immediately after the lunch, when, according to her, she had eaten the rest of the cake that Gail had brought and then thrown it up. That just hadn't sounded right to me. It just didn't fit a pattern I knew. To start eating without a plan, 2 boys in the next room. I don't know. No. Anyway, this became a moot point when the pre-trial material was released, and it was revealed that, immediately after the deadly lunch, Erin had collected a bunch of stuff and taken it to the Coonawarra transfer station. No, I'm not kidding. This isn't dubious phone evidence. The police had given the prosecution the CCTV footage from the Coonawarra transfer station, clearly showing Erin dumping stuff at the tip at 3:30 p.m. on the afternoon of the 29th of July, straight after the lunch. She's right there, on camera, staring us in the face. So when she had told us she was eating cake, everyone at the bar table, Nanette, Jane, Sarah, Colin, and Sophie, knew she was actually chucking stuff out at the tip. Can someone call a captain's challenge here? I mean, seriously, why would you not let a jury know that? If you want Justice Beale's answer, it's because whatever Erin was throwing out, it was never identified, so it could have been entirely innocent. Therefore, if we had known about this trip to the tip, it might have led to a prejudice that she was hiding something when she wasn't. At this point, I thought the law had gone way too far in not trusting juries with salient facts. The prosecution also had very good evidence to prove that Erin's regular garbage bins were nearly empty. If she was chucking out something innocently, why not just put it in the bin? But because the prosecution had no evidence to suggest that what she had chucked out had not been innocuous, the whole trip had been ruled inadmissible. What do you think she was getting rid of? Here's my guess. Don, Gail, Heather and Ian had all left at around 2:45 or 2:50 p.m. Jack and Barnaby were home. Jack helped clean up a bit, apparently, and then the boys went into the TV computer room. After that, to be at the tip by 3:30 p.m, Erin literally would have had 10 to 15 minutes to pack stuff up, dump it in her car and head off. Obviously, this was planned. She wasn't standing around thinking, I wonder what I should do now. There were some things she already knew she had to dispose of quickly. Like, I suggest, 4 grey plates and an orangey tan one. Those plates would have had a lot of bits and pieces on them. What are you going to do? Put them in the dishwasher? Erin had done enough Googling to know that heat doesn't destroy Amanita toxins. That's why she put them in a 180 degrees Celsius oven. And she knew it only took a tiny amount of Amanita toxin to kill a person. Do you think she was going to risk exposing herself and the kids to that? Putting them through the dishwasher posed a minuscule risk, but why take it? Just get rid of them. I can't say for sure. No one can. And Erin's never going to tell us the truth. But immediately after her lunch on the 29th of July, she took something down to the Coonawarra transfer station when she had plenty of room in her normal bins for regular garbage. As a juror who had gulped and made the call on a verdict that could condemn Erin to 3 decades or more behind bars, it was some relief to know that the pre-trial material had only served to confirm we were right. Our juries could be so much better with just a little more trust from the law. I really believe that. But until you've been on one of these juries, you won't really understand how pretty damn good it is. I don't know what else I'll ever do in my life. I'm still rebuilding it. Will I ever make a major contribution to Australian society? God knows. But I did give justice to Don and Gail Patterson and Heather and Ian Wilkinson. Even as an atheist, I'll pray for them. On the 8th of September 2025, I snuck in with the general public to hear Erin being sentenced to life imprisonment. The prosecution had asked that she never be released. In the end, however, Justice Beale gave her a non-parole period of 33 years. Her one show of emotion was to scowl at the media table when Beale spoke of the intense media pressure the case had drawn and how the notoriety she had gained because of this would make her jail time harder. Erin's disdain and anger at the enormous media attention she has had to endure are easy to understand. Ironically, the solitary confinement she would have to suffer because of it was also the main reason Justice Beale gave for deciding that one day she would be eligible for release.